there, radio fans. This is Carl Castaneda back again with Nintendo Pirate Radio. This show is going to be a continuation from last week, where we're going to talk more about game journalism. But this week it's going to be a little more specialized. We're going to start out with we brought in Johnny. Say hello, Johnny.
Hello.
We brought in Johnny to talk about his experience with PR. But of course, like last time, I'm joined by Stan Ferguson, our lovely sports editor.
Hello.
So let's get the ball rolling, guys. Johnny, what have you got for us?
Oh, it's going to be like that, huh? I just have to start talking?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
It's your show to run.
Pirate Radio, man. This is your turn to walk the plank.
Yeah, I feel like it. No, actually, I was listening to the last podcast that you guys did, and I thought you... I think the subject of PR in this business needs to be brought up more often. Because people should know as much as they can about the process that this information is brought to them. You guys did a good job of talking about it, but neither of you have really worked directly with PR, at least not very much. And I've been doing PR for Planet GameCube since roughly 2001. I kind of started it. Billy had contacts with Nintendo of America before I joined up, but we didn't have a whole lot other than that. So I kind of started from ground zero, making phone calls and sending emails. And it took a long time to get it built up, but it's a fairly smooth running machine now, I like to think. Sometimes not so much, but it works out okay. But yeah, I think... PR, I think that it came across very negatively last time, and it comes across that way in the One Up Yours episodes about it that I've listened to, and I think there's a lot of negative stuff to be said about PR, because as journalists, we are really their adversaries. I mean, we're trying to get the information out to people, and
they're trying to keep it in.
Yeah, for the most part. But not always, not necessarily. That's not all they do.
At least.
And I kind of wanted to give people a little broader picture of what PR does and how we work with them. Because it's not always the situation of, you know, we need more info and they won't give it to us. And it's not always a situation of we write something and then they tell us, oh, you can't do it that way, or we want you to include this or that. It's not really like that. It is sometimes, but usually not. Basically, publicists, PR people, control the flow of information out of a company. And because of the PR institution, we don't really have very much direct access to game developers. We have some. It depends on the developer. We have, sometimes private contacts, and they'll say things that we can't publish and things like that. A lot of media outlets have that. But as far as if I want new screenshots of a game, I can't go to the developer, which would be the obvious choice for that because they have the most up-to-date build. They have the technology to capture the screens and all that. I have to go through PR generally. And the reason for that is that PR wants to control which screenshots are released. And there are some legitimate reasons for doing that. They may want to make sure that there are no spoiler screenshots of the areas in the later game or, important parts of the story. They may want to limit the screenshots to areas of the game that are farthest along in development so that people don't get a poor image of the game from looking at unfinished stuff, And they may want to make sure that there's an even mix of, single-player, multiplayer, this mode, that mode. And sometimes they do a pretty good job of that, and a lot of times they don't. That's part of it. And basically, the other part of it is that, and this is the negative part, is that if I want more assets, or I want more information, or I want an interview, and the publishers basically decided that it's not time for that yet, or this is not a game that they really want to spend their efforts on promoting because they have a bunch of other games that they're working on. Basically, they'll just shut me down.
Usually, the way I've always noticed it, when PR sends out screenshots or new facts or like that, it's all kind of funneled to a general audience other than being specialized.
Yeah.
For example, like, IGN can't just be like, oh, hey, can I have, you know, screenshots of this area? That's just not going to happen. Like, they're going to release it, you know, all at once. Or you might get, like, exclusive screenshots every once in a while. But for the most part, it's mass-produced release.
Yeah, usually they send that stuff out to everybody at the same time. So, you know, they kind of make it known that it doesn't do a lot of good to send individual requests and say, hey, can I get this? Now, the exception to that is if you're coming into the game later and there's already been material released for it and you just don't know where to get it, a PR person can be very helpful in saying, oh, go to this FTP site, log in with this information, and you can get everything that we've put up. So, I mean, that's a valuable service if it's a game that, for instance, was just announced for your platform and it's been announced for other platforms for a while earlier, or for other kinds of publications where, you know, they don't necessarily follow a game from the day it's announced up until it's released and afterwards, you know. So, that's another side of it. But I'm trying to think what I want to say next about it. Do you guys have any questions about the way the relationship works?
I think a lot of these concerns that are being brought up are actually more from the new games journalism side, which is these people who want to be, you know, like I said before, in the trenches. They want to be there. They want to report about it. They want to talk about what's going on. But they're not allowed that access because they don't want that information leaking out.
Yeah, if you're talking about, like, investigative reporting on video games...
Like, that doesn't happen that often.
Well, it's not going to. Because investigative reporting generally, in the general media, okay, on CNN and things like that, tends to be about things that are out there, but nobody knows about it yet. So, you know, someone gets an idea for, you know, to look up information and do some research on something, and they compile some facts and they put together a report. Well, the difference is when you're talking about a game and you're trying to get information on a game, all the information about that game is either under the complete control of the publisher and thus the PR people, or it's stuff that you can infer from maybe the history of the series or of the developer or something like that. But if you want people to be, you know, sneaking into development studios and snapping secret photographs and things like that, I don't think that's ever going to happen. And the companies have an interest in keeping that. You know, we all, as Nintendo fans, are used to Nintendo being really, really secretive.
Yeah.
But, you know, then you look at a case where Sony's basically copied the motion sensing controller from Wii 6 months after it was announced for Nintendo system. And you can see that Nintendo does have a lot of justification for that because they tend to be on the cutting edge, at least creatively, if not technologically.
Right.
And for them, ideas are business. And it's very easy to steal an idea. Once it becomes a product and it's trademarked and people identify it with that brand, you know, then you don't have to worry about it so much. But if they just talked about everything that they have, everyone else would copy it, and they might even put out a crappier version of it before the real thing comes out. And that is really dangerous to a company like Nintendo because they're a creative company. They're an idea company. And so they have a legitimate reason for being secretive, and the PR people are part of that wall of secrecy. You know, when I go in and I'm trying to find information about Wii, you know, those PR people are there to basically tell me, hey, you're not going to get it, and we'll let you know when it's ready. And in other words, they're going to tell everybody at the same time.
Right.
And they have justifiable reasons for doing that, although it is extremely frustrating for us, especially, you know, those of us who are reporting on it, because we want so badly to get this information and get it out to the people, and the publisher wants to make sure that doesn't happen until they are ready for it. It's about controlling information. And so there is that adversarial quality to the relationship that we have with PR. But again, sometimes they can be very helpful, and part of their job is to help us. In fact, one of the things I find that PR is helpful for is that they can sometimes, you know, the part of PR at least is the publicist, and this is a person whose job it is to take a game that's being worked on that maybe people don't know that much about and try to get the word out and build up some hype for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the practice of doing that through guerrilla marketing or whatever, you know, like fake people on forums and stuff like that is rightly controversial.
Viral marketing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff happens. But really what a publicist does is they send me an email and say, hey, check out, you know, this video of this game that you don't have anything up on your website about, you know. And if it's for a system that we write about, and it, you know, I'm going to try to get something up about it. And I might, I mean, I probably did know about it before, but I may not have known that that information was available.
Right.
So they can be really helpful in that. Or sometimes it's a game that we know of its existence. You know, maybe we saw it at E3, but they want to follow up with us and say, hey, would you guys like to do an interview with the developer? And I'm cool with that. I like doing interviews because we can get information that's very specific to our audience. You know, we can ask the technical stuff. We can ask, you know, what did you do to make this special for the Nintendo platform, if it's a multi-platform game, and things like that. We can ask them things about developing for the system, especially, you know, right now when you have a new system coming out. And, you know, the PR person coordinates that entire thing. They may even propose the interview to begin with, although sometimes we ask for it initially. They will be a point of contact. We can send questions to them, or we can set up a time for a phone interview with them. They go set it up on the other end, and they make it happen. And that's a useful function. And it's something that we could probably do ourselves, but sometimes they make it a lot easier and a lot better. You know, for instance, doing interviews with anybody in Japan would be a real logistical nightmare to set up for ourselves. But Nintendo has translators in-house. They have conference calling equipment and everything, and they can set all that up, and they've done it before in interviews that we've been a part of. And that's extremely helpful, you know. So they're still controlling the information, but in this case, they're actually, in controlling it, they're actually helping to get more information out there through us to our readers, which maybe otherwise wouldn't get out there. And so we try to take advantage of that, and it's helpful. And yeah, they're feeding us information, and when appropriate, we're going to make sure that, you know, any PR spin that they put on it, we're going to try to see through that. Or, you know, in the case of interview questions, we're going to throw some things in there to make sure that we're going to hold their feet to the fire a little bit, so that it's not just blatant promotion. I mean, I certainly don't want our site to become Entertainment Tonight. Which is,
right.
You know, this the host is like, you won't believe what Tom Cruise is up to in his new movie. And it's like, you know, it's blatant schlock promotion. And they have no interest in filtering out the bullshit that PR people put on it. And we do. And in fact, that's part of, it's why in our news department, we post press releases verbatim right on the site, and we put it in small text so the readers can see that that is a press release. Because I think it's actually, you know, a lot of people think that journalists should rewrite press releases. Actually, according to Stephen Colbert, that's what journalists do. but I think for one thing, it's a waste of time to just rewrite it and basically say exactly the same thing in so many words. Because, you know, we're not getting paid to do this. I'd rather us spend our efforts on editorial content rather than rewriting press releases, which is 90% of the news you see on sites like IGN, 1UP, places like that. Their press releases, I get exactly the same ones, and they just give it to an intern or whoever and say, hey, write this up. And they're just going to switch all the sentences around. And it's a waste of time. And I think it's actually valuable to the reader to see the form in which that information is sent directly to us without changing it at all. Because they can see, you know, what all PR spin is in there is still there. I mean, it's naked for the world to see. Whereas if it filters through us and we try to rewrite it all, you know, you may think, oh, well, especially if we don't filter out the spin, if we leave it in there, then that becomes very disingenuous, and you know, I think that can be
it's
quite misleading.
Our opinion.
Yeah, basically. So, I'd prefer to give that unfiltered and let people see it for what it is. And part of the effect of that, especially if if we could get more major sites to do that, what you would find is that press releases would be better written, more informative, and more fact-based, without all this silly hype kind of commentary that they put in it. Because they don't want people to see that. They use those phrases to lead us and try to influence us to say nice things about the game. But they don't really want the readers to see that that's the way they market it to professional journalists, you know? I'm not saying that's what we are, but we're kind of.
Well, yeah. We try our best.
Yeah.
And that leads to, you know, the concern a lot of people have with these, Dan Su pointed out in EGM not so long ago.
Oh, the thing on editorial integrity?
Right, the fear about them selling ad space for feature content.
I don't know how, you know, common that is. In my experience, like in people that I know who work in game journalism, that's something that I've rarely ever heard about. I've only heard about, you know, people who are requested to change things, and there was that thing a while back when GameSpy changed that review, like it changed from like a 1.5 out of 5 to a 3 out of 5. But generally, you don't really hear about a publisher saying, "Hey, here's $5,000, give us a 10 out of 10." Like that, I don't think
I don't think that exists. If it does, it's rare. I've never heard of it personally. I've never been offered anything like that. I think the PR influence is exerted in a more subtle fashion, and it's their job to exert that pressure, and it's our job to resist it. So.
Right. And actually, when I was contacted, I believe I was contacted directly by the developer, not even by the PR, about the game I reviewed.
Yeah.
Oh, what a sad story that was.
It happens occasionally, but...
You know, it's that Warner Brothers thing. You know, they got to make that score, that 7 out of 10.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Or else they get fined.
It's more common that actually the publicist will contact you about a bad review. And they'll say, hey, you know, they want to make sure that you played the entire game.
Right.
And mainly what they look for is not, hey, why didn't you give this a 9? They want to, you know, they, a lot of times when I have publicists contact me about review scores, they point to a game rankings percentage or something like that, and they want to say, why is the review on your site so much lower than everyone else, you know? Is your guy just biased against this type of game? And that's a legitimate question. I mean, it's telling that it comes from the publicist. You know, he's trying to find something to break down the validity of the review. And I'll defend it. You know, we have an editorial process, and we look over these things. So I'm going to defend it. And if there's some fact that we got wrong, you know, if there's a multiplayer mode that we didn't mention or that we didn't even know was there, that's uncommon. But I've seen it happen, especially on other sites.
I've definitely had. There's definitely been a few times when I've reviewed a game and I reviewed it way lower than. You know, I think my first review for the site was Fight Night Round 2, and the general, like, generally it got, like, an 85 or something on game rankings and Metacritics, but I gave it, like, a 75%. And so it was weird that, like, I looked at it, and they generally didn't dip below an 8 out of 10, and so it was, and so I could see why a publisher might say that and be like, well, what's wrong with this review? Why does he have all these concerns that no one else is bringing up? But I mean, I don't know. That it's just my personal preference. My beef with that game was that the analog nub was weird, or not the nub, but the stick.
Well, you know, a lot of times, I think we tend to be pretty thorough with our reviews.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, what I'll find is that when I give a score to a game that's significantly lower, you know, 20 or 30% lower than what you see at other sites, a lot of times. I'm citing issues with the game that no one else even mentions. It's not even that they mention it in passing and they say it's no big deal. I mean, that kind of subjectivity is understandable. But a lot of times what I find is that, you know, I'm complaining about serious design flaws that suck the fun out of the game and make it unenjoyable to play or just make it very, very frustrating. And a lot of
AKA
other places just don't
AKA Beautiful Joe, Red Hot Rumble.
Yeah, well, I didn't play it. Don't know.
Ugh, You're lucky.
So, you know, maybe, and of course the publicist is trying to find something wrong with the lowest review, but I think when readers see a review at our site that's considerably lower than at other places, in addition to asking, you know, what did we not like about the game that other people did like or didn't care about, they might also want to ask, what did we see in the game that other people didn't see? You know, in other words, it's not always the case, but sometimes it's not that there's anything wrong with our review, it's that there's something wrong with all the other ones. And that sounds maybe a little egocentric, but it has happened, actually. So.
Yeah. And a lot of times they want to know what they did wrong, so I guess they could make it better.
The good developers do, yeah. The good ones.
But I guess this segues into our next segment, if it's all right with you guys, which is the state of actual writing, like how, you know, how should I word this? But the quality of the writing that you see in game journalism, because Game Daily recently put out an article that said, it was basically, I think the headline was, Why Game Journalism Sucks.
Yeah.
And the reason that they said was because the copy editing and general lack of finesse in writing didn't make it journalism at all, but more, you know, like more of a rant.
Yeah.
Right, and actually, more to the point, I believe the quote was, because we suck.
Because we suck. Well, hey, man, you know, don't put me in that list.
No, actually, since you guys are both fairly new on the staff within the past year and a half or 2 years, I want to ask you, were you surprised at the level of editing at Planet GameCube once you got on the staff and saw how the process worked?
Absolutely. Here's the editing process at the website that worked at before Planet GameCube. I wrote it, and then they told me whether or not like they agreed with my review. Not necessarily that they agreed with the way I wrote the review, but whether or not they agreed with the score.
Yeah.
and then if that, like, that's the most you'll ever see. And then it comes back and like, okay, hit now, post it.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely the whole, you know, you every part of our reviews. I don't know if the readers know this, but every single part of our review is, you know, looked at very closely to see if there's anything in there that might be fixed, that'll be able to be fixed. So it's definitely a lot more complex and a lot more effective than people might think.
Well, me coming into Planet GameCube, I actually, you know, since I had zero experience writing reviews for any site, I didn't really have any real expectation. I was actually hoping for a pretty good copy edit, because everyone else, when I read their reviews, were very well written. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it looked like either, you know, that there was always someone behind it making sure that it was okay, because I didn't find any major grammatical errors.
To Johnny's credit.
Absolutely. And so, you know, it was something that I was hoping for, but since I had no experience before to see, like, what other copy edit processes were, this was my first time.
Yeah.
And it really met my expectations of what I wanted it to be.
Well, I can tell you, I don't think we have the most exhaustive editing process, you know, among our competition, but I think we have one of the best. And, in fact, I think you would find, at least from what I've heard and from what I can tell just by reading, that there are sites a lot bigger than us and more corporate, you know, with stockholders, really, that don't have nearly the editing process that we do.
Oh, yeah,
and,
definitely.
You know, that's one of the things that I put into place. I did it personally after the very first review that we ever posted, which was for Super Mario Advance. And I took a look at it, and I said, this is embarrassing. Yeah, I mean, someone else wrote it, and I said, you know, this is really embarrassing. It was just full of so many spelling and grammar mistakes, and I said to Billy, I want you to send this stuff to me before it goes online, and just let me take a look at it. I'll send it back to the writer, and if they don't agree with it, they can, you know, ignore me, but I want to make this stuff better. And that kind of developed into the process we have now, where we have four or five people editing, and someone catches literally almost every single thing that goes up on the website. Someone with experience and some technical language skill has taken a look at it, and not only covered it for, you know, spelling, typos, grammar mistakes, things like that, but also the actual content of the article. We want to make sure, if, you know, in a review, if you say this game is great or it sucks, that you have points to back it up and that it's believable and that your explanation of how the game works or what's wrong with it makes sense and is not confusing. Because, that, I mean, that's easy to it's easy to do. And we just want to make sure that when the average person reads this, they understand it as well as the writer did when he was writing it. And, you know, I think it's been a great, great help to us. And I hope you guys feel that it helps you to become a better writer and that it elevates the overall quality of what's on the site. That's my hope. That's my hope.
Absolutely. I've actually, you know, there's been many times where I've been challenged on the on my scores, whether they be high or low. And, you know, I always back it up, and I don't think I've ever changed the score.
Yeah, and we're not asking you to. I mean, when I look at a score, what I'm looking for is not, oh, this is way higher than I would have thought. You know, there must be something wrong with it. What I'm looking for is that the words and the text of the review match the scores to a reasonable extent. I want to make sure there's no great logical leap from, you know, and you see that at other sites. I think sometimes you look at the score and then you read the review and they just don't seem to match up. And so what I'm looking for is that, you know, if you say, if you give the sound a 4 or a 3 out of 10, you know, that you're going to say something to back that up to make it justifiable. And right. So usually what we're asking people to do is not to raise or lower a score by a point. I say, can you add another sentence explaining why it got this score? Because I don't understand it from reading the review, and I don't think other people will either.
But another thing that I always, that I'm really thankful for is that if a review might seem, maybe seem a little too early, not necessarily that we didn't play enough of the game, but just we haven't given it enough time to marinate or, you know, enough time to really get a good idea of how the game plays. Like, that happened to me recently with Naruto Clash of Ninja.
Yeah.
Where I played the game, because, like, you can beat the game and everything and get everything in the game within, you know, a day.
Yeah.
So I waited a few days, and then I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to write the review. And then I got, you know, I got an email from Johnny and I think Ty and Dan just saying, listen, you know, give it more time. And sure enough, they were right, because the more time I gave it, the more, not only did I understand the game more, but since I had given it time, I had gained the perspective to write about it with more finesse and, you know, a lot more ease, which is, you know, something that obviously makes writing the review a lot easier.
Yeah.
Right. And that's something actually I do. I play the game to the point where I know how I feel about it, and I know how I feel about it isn't going to change, and then I don't go straight to writing. I just let it sink in and think, okay, what's my hook? What am I going to do to... What's my theme for this review?
What's your main point? I mean, what do you want to tell people?
Well, there's the main point, and then there's like a theme, and I just want to say, how do I want to tell these... What do I want to tell it, and how do I want to tell it?
Yeah.
And that's what I go into... when writing a review. Now, when the game is hardly even worth that effort, like Greg Hastings.
gotta love that paintball.
I just sit there and go, oh, God, how can I inflict this game as much damage as it has inflicted on me?
Speaking of PR, probably going to get a call about this.
Activision's going to pull the plug on our website, man. You know, we're going to be Planet Activision by tomorrow.
No, and you know, I'm not even specifically talking about Activision, but a lot of, you know, publicists are real people, and a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are real gamers. And
oh yeah, definitely.
They will fight for a game when it's current. And you know, they want to make sure that you give it you know, a fair amount of time, a fair amount of coverage, that you have everything you need to do to write it. And they'll treat every game as if it's the next masterpiece. You know, even stuff that is obviously not and never was going to be. But usually in retrospect, you know, 6 months down the line, if I am talking to them about something else and this old game comes up, or if I see them at some event, they'll be honest and they'll say, yeah, that was really a piece of crap, wasn't it? I mean, they know, but it's their job to treat it, you know, like it's a big deal. So
right.
it's not a job that I would want to have as a publicist, because basically you're paid to lie, or at least spin, which is kind of a more, you know, shady way of doing it. But they have a job to do, and they do it, but they're not vindictive about it, I don't think. You know, later on, they'll be honest later on once it doesn't matter anymore.
And I'm sure they're happy when you break the norm and give a game a really high score when it's maybe not doing so well.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which brings us to our last segment.
Well done. Nice.
Yeah, oh yeah, dude. I have this crap planned out, man. I got this thing rolling.
The master of Segi.
Oh, yeah, oh, exactly. Stan.
Yes, sir.
Remember that game, Mario Tennis, when it came out for the GBA?
Vaguely, something.
Maybe?
Yeah, it's triggering something in my mind.
You know? I remember it being very good.
It was not a bad game at all, to say the least.
But,
you know?
For our listeners who have no idea what we're talking about right now, Stan published a review, when was it? Like, late 2005, I think.
It was either early October, early November. I think it was early November, mid-November.
And he gave Mario Tennis, what was it, Power Tour, I think it was called?
Yeah.
Right.
A 10 out of 10, which
straight
is,
up,
you know, the highest honor we at PGC can give. So, obviously, I mean, I met it with suspicion. I was like, wow, really? Is this game really a 10? And, you know, I work with this guy.
Yeah, and it was one of my first reviews,
yeah, exactly.
too.
So like, I was like, at first I was like, "What? Does he know what a good game is?" I mean, but, you know, sure, and he did back up his points very well. But then later on, at the end of the year, Something Awful did their annual worst video game article feature. And Stan, you know, sure enough, he made
I was
the list.
Number five.
Number five.
I was the least worst.
You were the least worst. You were the best of the worst. Like,
congratulations.
Like, exactly, yeah. And so, explain to us, Stan, what was that like?
Well, I figured it out through an email that was started out by Lindy, Jonathan Linderman, mm-hmm. on staff. And I was like, what? Why would anyone care what I write? So I went and checked it out, and I was like, oh, okay. And basically all it was, you know, it was a comedy piece.
Right.
You know, about things that really annoy them in journalism. And what they were picking out from ours specifically was they were trying to point out that, you know, we're playing a GameCube, so obviously we're sided towards Nintendo, and we're going to love anything that's Mario on it. They don't know is the individual reviewer.
Right.
I am actually not a huge fan of Mario. I'm a Zelda fan.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I love the Super Mario games, and they're cool, but Super Mario Sunshine did nothing for me. I will not touch a Mario Party game. I wasn't even looking forward playing Mario Tennis Power Tour. I was like, oh crap, a GBA game. Oh well, I'm new here. I gotta give it my best shot.
They do show up on our doorstep every now and then.
Yeah. And I took the game, and I plugged it in, and I'm playing it, and I realized I don't want to put it down. I am actually enjoying this game. I take it to work, and I'm playing it nonstop. I'm not answering my patient's call lights. I'm playing this game. And I thought, okay, I love this game. I'm telling people at work why I love this game. I can't stop it, playing it. They're seeing me play it. I couldn't say I've never played a game that made me feel as happy and like as being like a kid when I played that
so
game.
So what you're saying, Stan, what you're saying is that this game is significant.
This game is significant. And actually what I meant by that was it's significant in the fact that it's actually proving that there's a little bit of life left in the GBA. Not that it is significant. This can change the world.
Yes. Mario Power Tennis, whatever the hell it's called. This is an art piece. It's going to stay in the test of time, isn't that right?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be up there with Da Vinci and Shakespeare, absolutely. You know, people will not forget this.
Exactly.
But, no, really, as far as I was concerned, a 10 out of 10 was the best in the genre that it could possibly be. Now, I know there are not a lot of competitors for the RPG tennis game
on
handheld,
the GBA.
You know, so obviously right then and there, it's going to be the best out of all the ones available. Just like, oh, the paintball game is the best DS paintball game. However, however, there's a distinct lack of quality.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you compare the two. And this was obviously a very fun game. It was as good as it possibly could be. There was always something to do. There was always something to go back to. There was a good, you know, functional multiplayer game, but it was also excelled at what a handheld game should be, which is a single-player experience, at least in my opinion.
Mm.
And at no point did I not enjoy myself. At no point did I feel it was unfair or too difficult or too easy. You know, there was you could always make it what you needed it to be, and you always felt like you were progressing better and better and actually, you know, gaining in skills. So, you know, here I took it and said, you know, I'm going to make it 10 out of 10. Now, as far as the hyperbole in the review, I acknowledge it, yes, but there was a reason for it. And the reason for the hyperbole was I could not fathom how I was going to write a good review. I've always ranted about things. I've always said negative things about things. I'm very good at pointing out the awful and having fun with it.
Uh-huh.
At no point really did I have a lot to say good things. And, you know, I wanted to say, okay, I got to give this a good review. There's nothing really bad I can say about it. But how do I make it interesting for the reader? How do I keep their attention focused on it?
Well,
so I tried to use a little bit of... I tried to pepper it with imagery.
Well,
basically.
Well, for me, writing a review for a great game has always been, you know, pretty easy. Like, I remember when I reviewed Path of Radiance, which is an excellent game. You know, it was pretty easy to review. And bad games are also a lot of fun to review. Like, you know, again, Red Hot Rumble. It broke my heart, but the review was really easy to write.
So, see, mediocre reviews I can write, and bad reviews I can write just, like, off the top of my head.
Dude, if it's, like, a 7 out of 10 game or, like, a 6.5 out of 10 game, it is, like, the hardest thing for me to do. Unless, with one exception, the hardest review I ever had to write was Killer7. Because that game, you cannot talk about the game without writing a book about the game.
Right.
It's too layered and all this extra crap. But... you know, it's just, yeah, for me, like, one of the hardest reviews I ever read for, like, a mediocre game was, like, Batman Begins.
the hardest review I've ever had to write, I think, was Need for Speed Most Wanted GBA. That damn thing took me forever. The DS... the DS one was a little bit harder, but it was just so bland.
Right.
It was such a dull game. And then the third one... I already written two Need for Speed reviews. Like, what more can I say? You know? And at the same time, be relevant to this game. It's better, at least, than the DS version. Was pretty much the only sentence that was floating in my head. You know, the whole review could be something. You know, linking to the DS thing and saying, it's better than this one. You know?
Well, Stan, the way I felt about the Mario Tennis review was that I felt that you basically... And correct me if I'm wrong, but your point was not that this was the best tennis RPG hybrid on GBA or anything like that. The reason that you gave it a 10 is because it's basically a near-perfect handheld sports game. And,
exactly.
And the significance of that, if I may use your word, is is that this is a genre that is typically not done well, if at all, on handhelds. And as a sports fan, as you are, you know, playing FIFA and Madden and things like that, to get a handheld sports game and find that it's actually not only really fun, a great representation of the sport, but it's designed in such a way that it works really, really well on a handheld. Whereas, you know, taking the GameCube Mario Tennis game and just basically porting that down to Game Boy Advance would not work very well. But they added these RPG elements and the style of the game and the difficulty curve, basically all put together, made it a sports game and a true sports game and a great representation of the sport, but also just a brilliant handheld game that you could pick up and enjoy the hell out of, even if you don't even care about tennis. which you don't, right?
Right.
And that's what convinced me that you were being earnest and you weren't just completely exaggerating everything in the review.
Yeah, you're right. Tennis bores me. But, so does golf, but I love golf games. I love the Tiger Woods series. Even though I only gave it like a 7.5, that was mostly due to the horrid control scheme. But, it's fun to play. it's fun to play. But, yeah, that's what was impressive. You know, when you take a tennis game, plus I don't even really care that much for handheld games. The DS intrigues me in the way that it allows you play handheld games, but... You know, when I got my Game Boy when I was little, I played Tetris, then I got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and then I realized I really don't want to play this thing.
I got my Game Boy for Pokemon.
Oh, I was long before Pokemon. I was there when the damn thing first came out in junior high. And, I just really don't care about handheld gaming. It's not as immersive for me as console game.
Well, to me, the DS is not even like a handheld anymore. It's like it's getting such a vast library of great games. It seems to have like surpassed handheld gaming, where it's like something between console and handheld.
It's transcended its own little boundary,
right.
Basically. I guess you could say there's still not a whole lot of DS games that I want to go ahead and buy and play. But there is a lot coming out that I find intriguing. I do miss those PC adventure games.
Ooh,
so
Hotel Dusk.
Hotel Dusk I'm looking forward to, absolutely. And especially the style and the way that you actually hold DS just like in Brain Age, like a book, and interrogate. At least that's what it states in the fact sheet.
That's what it says in our official printed game preview.
But, that kind of stuff intrigues me. That's the kind of thing that I would rather get out of handheld gaming rather than just another little handheld sports game, just another little platform, game. And let's face it, the GBA was notorious for crappy Nickelodeon games.
Well, yeah. Sure. It's true. As our former Australian correspondent can probably attest to.
And now Jeff Shirley.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, Jeff has always been into that, but he's got to kind of pick up the slack now that Ben's not here.
Right. Oh, poor guy.
No, he loves it. He loves it,
though. That's how he feeds on it.
You should see at E3, we'll go to, the Nintendo press conference, and whatever game looks the worst, we'll go back to the hotel, and Jeff will say, "Hey, I want early dibs on that." And he volunteers actively for this stuff, really.
Wow.
He's a special breed, man. We're lucky to have him.
I occasionally want to try them out, but that's why I kind of wanted to dip in the waters by taking a Mega Man Battle Network 6, which
braver than I am.
Hey, the crazy thing is, since I've never played the series before, I actually find the battles kind of enjoyable.
Yeah,
but the story is even more so, and it's ludicrous.
Get it? The main character's name is Lan. Ha 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 ha.
And Mega Man's real name is Hub, I think.
Really?
At least, yeah. The there's this little scene. I spoiler alert.
Uh-oh.
Where Lan's dad is contacting him and Mega Man, and he says three names. He says Lan, Mega Man, and Hub. So I imagine Hub, who Lan also says when talking to Mega Man, is Mega Man's real name, and I'm kind of trying to piece together this story, but I think Hub was Lan's dead brother something like that. I don't know. It's just really weird.
That's all major kinds of spoiler alert. Sorry to all you future Battle Mega Man players, all both of
well,
you.
Well, no. I imagine this stuff was revealed in previous Battle Network games, because it sure isn't making a whole hell of a lot of sense to me.
Stan, I'm going to guess you could go online and find fan fiction about this series that would clear up all of your questions. But we've been talking for about 45 minutes. Do we need to wrap it up pretty soon?
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, well,
we could talk all day,
Exactly. I was talking to Samuel earlier about how we might just be able to do a two-hour epic.
We probably could if we really wanted to.
But in the interest of keeping things nice and manicured, I'll cut it to a close.
And now it's time to say goodbye.
Parting. I don't remember the words of the song. But This has been another episode of Radio Free Nintendo Special Nintendo Pirate Radio Edition. I'm your MC, Carl Castaneda, preview/rumors editor. My special co-host, as always, Stan Ferguson. And special guest star and director of PlanetGameCube.com, Johnny Metz.
Arr.
And let's give it up for Johnny Metz.
I'm the only one who really cares about the pirate.
I mean, none of us can remember what the name is. I mean, none of us can even remember what the name is. In the last podcast, I kept calling it, like, Radio Nintendo Pirates and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think we started going with Nintendo Pirate Radio, I think is what we officially decided.
I think so. Someone,
NPR
someone up there in internet land, remind me. But as always, it's been a lot of fun. So tune in next week when Mike and Evan will probably return to bring you more podcast goodness. Send your various hate mail to podcast@planetgamecube.com and tell them how awful I am. But
hey,
how wonderful I am.
Actually, if you guys, I would like to request that if people listening are interested in this kind of discussion about, you know, PR and editing and writing reviews and the whole process of how this stuff works, let us know, because if this stuff is boring, we don't want to talk about it
anymore. But we could talk about it all day, trust us. You know.
Yeah, we could, but we don't want to, you know, bore people with these long conversations.
Well, I checked out the forum topic for the first part of the journalism epic, and a few guys there seem to really like it. I think Nino was going nuts.
Yeah, though there was a little bit of the touch on the art, that very volatile debate.
That's got it. We're gonna have to tackle that in a future podcast.
Let's not.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not going into that.
All right, so once again, this has been me, Carl, Stan, and Johnny. Sayonara, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.